We'll be starting off with Larry, Larry Frank, who most of you know. Larry is the Bombardier Chair in Sustainable Transport at UBC, and he's also a senior non-resident fellow of the Brookings Institute in Washington. He's been studying the effects of neighborhood walkability on travel patterns and sustainability for over 15 years. He's authored many papers on topics on health and the community design, the impacts of the built environment on physical activity, and urban sprawl and public health. Over the past decade, Larry and his colleagues have been working towards the development of evidence-based tools for evaluating relationships between community design, travel patterns, physical activity, obesity, air quality, fuel consumption, and climate change. So it's a full meal deal there with Larry.
So the theme and the structure of these shifting gear sessions is really to try to grapple or to begin to figure out how we're going to grapple with the changing transportation landscape. We're under much more pressure from a variety of different sectors of the economy. Anthony will talk about energy. I'm going to talk about first climate change and health. And this image that you're looking at is one that kind of came to me I have to admit, scarily in a dream. I had to present in Las Vegas, and I thought, how do you convey to people in Las Vegas the effect of climate change and energy? A lot of the our hopes are wrapped up in the left two wheels of the slot machine. We're thinking that technology is going to bail us out. Of course, we think that because it has in the past, and so we're thinking it's going to do it again. It's not going to do it again for us this time. It may bail us about halfway out. In fact, it looks like with an 80% reduction that we hope to achieve in greenhouse gas emissions, we're about able to get. And I'll actually do a little bit of a demo here in Seattle, where most of my research is based on this topic. But basically, fuel mix, you know, less CO2 per gallon of gas or liter, and vehicle efficiency, you know, cleaner cars, is about going to get us like about a 40% reduction by 2050 at best case scenario, and the rest is going to have to come from reducing our demand. So that's the climate change side, but a lot of what we're also looking at, and this is my own research, is also focusing on the health impacts. And there's a very clear convergence about the way we're growing and the effect of that there's a win-win or a lose-lose, shall we say, between the kinds of decisions we make about designing communities. So I wanted to kick off with a broad brush discussion about the question about where we grow and how we grow. And of course, metaphorically speaking, as the research shows, the design of communities is affecting or related with how much we as individuals are growing in terms of our own waistline. We are actually rapidly becoming an obesogenic society. The statistics are alarming. And with that comes significant healthcare costs. So we have managed, and I think the theme for me is we have perfected the externality in transportation, maybe as much or more than any other sector. In other words, we've externalized the environmental and health impacts or costs from the decision-making process beautifully. And that's not to be surprised because, in fact, there's a lot of benefits from basically it's the tragedy of the commons, from externalizing costs onto others. So it's no surprise to me when Health Canada, Environment Canada got together and commented on the terms of reference that the British Columbian government put together on the Gateway Project and basically said, how can you overlook induced demand of this project? It's been, you know, it was actually written out of the terms of reference for the project. So as someone who came here 4 years ago, now five, from the United States, you know, we look in Canada to the U.S. and think, what a mess. What an automobile dependent. I mean, I remember all kinds of things on listservs I've read about stupid, obese Americans that are so energy consumptive. And then I actually look at real evidence here in Canada when we start to measure it right, and we're no better. We're no better at all, except we're blaming everybody in America for being worse. And so I think that's even worse, to be honest. And I think as we start to think about a way forward, I think we're going to end up having to learn a little bit from our neighbors to the south again, because they're actually doing things in a way, stepping forward, where we in British Columbia are really falling way behind and resting, I think, on our laurels from years gone by where good decisions were being made. They're not being made now in that way. So land use decisions and transportation investments collectively form a built environment that do relate with or affect, I would argue, causally, although we haven't proved it yet, we will, that activity patterns and how we engage in our health. So basically how active we are through transportation, and that relates, as it seems to, consistently in now over 37 different studies with people's body weight and physical activity and body weight. You can think of it more in a linear left brain model, which is where we spend our money, or as a city government would need to think, or a regional transportation authority, that where you put your money in land use and transportation, where growth goes and how it's designed, and transportation investments, what mode we make our investments in, and where we invest, because where we invest, the where question, will determine where the growth will in fact go. So these two interact. However, as Clive and I were discussing, and as we all know, institutionally we have separated the authorities of land use and transportation powers at the regional level. So how can we even hope at this point to bring them together in a way that really needs to happen to even get at what goes to the right, which is the effects of them collectively and interactively on activity patterns, or what we do, where we spend our time, how we travel, and the outcomes that those have, or we call distally in research, air quality, physical activity, climate change, and then how that affects back again the bottom line, or money, public health, and the economy. So in a socialized healthcare system, we're in a situation where the decisions that other people make actually directly affect our own bottom line. So we need to think about that. I would argue, in fact, in the U.S., it's not really that different. In a privatized healthcare system, you end up with those costs anyways. So you can think of it in a multi-sectoral kind of an approach, which is, where is the win-win-win between these different sectors? So my hope is that health as a sector and environment as a sector get together and start to put some pressure on transportation to start to be more collaborative, because it is really difficult right now. And as a transportation professor, I think it's sort of interesting to say that, but I don't really see the kind of interactions that need to occur at the provincial level to really start to make some decisions that are going to really create healthier, more sustainable communities happening here. I see a lot of investments being made that are good in many ways and a lot of good intentions, but I think they fall apart when you start to look at the diametrically opposed regional planning that's going on on the Highway 1 corridor in particular, where most of the growth in the region is going to go. That said, I do see a lot of good transportation investments or sustainable approaches in other parts of the region. But it's difficult when you're going to primarily invest in highways and expect the growth to be sustainable, where most of the growth is going to go. So here's some of the research I wanted to present at the micro scale. So depending on where you live, if you live in an unwalkable or more automobile-dependent environment, or in a more walkable place where you have lots of different shops and services nearby, we can predict the kind of different travel patterns that you might engage in, or those different outcomes I showed in that graph. So this is how the research that we do is designed, and I'll mention in a little bit some of the work we're doing here, but basically this is a behavior shed, or a 1 kilometer area around your house. It's shaped like this because the road network means that even if you live here, and it's only that very short distance over to this neighborhood, you can't get there because, of course, it's designed to be separate. And that's actually how a lot of the suburbs are being built here in our region, and most of the rest of North America and Western world. A lot of smart growth is being built, but not as much as what's going on here. The truth is that we see, by living in central Vancouver, a lot of smart growth happening around us, but in fact, when you look at the lion's share of the growth, it's actually a lot more like this than like this. So basically, what's nearby is far away or too far to walk. In Vancouver, we've been mapping this extensively and have a very detailed database at the postal code level, just showing the levels of walkability. In fact, just if you want to think of it thematically, you can just see the more walkable areas are in the darker red. In fact, I would argue that we have been intending to reverse the color scheme. So you can see we've aligned all the communities in our region and have a sense pretty clearly, based on the walkability that comes from our measures of mixing of uses, density, street connectivity, retail FSR, or compactness, or is a building set back from the curb, or does it have a sea of parking in front of it? So we've got measures of compactness and proximity to uses where people live, and then connectivity of the road network, all these factors of walkability rolled up into an index. And when you look at it together, you can see who's the least and who's the most, quote, walkable. So that's just a sense of this. But we have a lot of data on this. If you're interested, it's on our website. But basically, you can see places like where we are now is on the high end of the scale, like a little block, a neighborhood, Homer Street and Pender, Broadway, West End, near McDonald's, so a slightly lower density. It's not quite as compact or perhaps quite as walkable, maybe a little more desirable in some ways. You can see 62nd Avenue and 120th Street in Surrey, and then all the way, you know, down at the least walkable level would be something bisected by interstate or freeway, inner province freeway. And basically, you can just see the kind of levels of walkability in real places. So it helps us because we can start to predict behavior. I don't know if you can see this, it's a little foggy. But a report we recently did for the Vancouver Foundation shows, for example, urban core, inner suburb, outer suburb, and rural suburban, and you can see the percent that are obese. And as you move from the urban to the edge, you see it go from 35% to 52%, up to 61 or 62%. So the rate of obesity increases steadily as you move from the center to the edge of the region. There's a lot of self-selection going on here, I'll tell you that. It's not just the neighborhood or the environment. People choose neighborhoods based on their preferences. But there's clearly a pattern going on here. And obesity is a really important predictor for healthcare problems or chronic disease or type 2 diabetes. It's pretty serious. In fact, the statistics are alarming. If you put some dollars behind it, it gets a lot of eyebrows raised. So how many walked at least 150 minutes in the previous week, or a threshold that health care professionals would care about? And you can see a steady decline, but a little bit of increase in the rural suburban goes down and then a little bit back up, which is interesting. Engaged in at least 150 minutes of moderate activity per week, and you can see a steady decline, a little bit back up at the edge. So that's a bit of an anomaly, and that might be people who have closer proximity to recreation right at the very edge of the region, and probably not a lot of activity for walking for utility or transportation and so forth. So that pattern follows, and I thought it would be interesting just to show you some local data. Climate change follows, or greenhouse gas emissions, urban form, pretty clearly based on vehicle miles traveled. You can see CO2 kilograms per day, per person, as density increases in Seattle, for example, steady decline, no surprise there, distances are shorter. Another relationship would be intersections per acre, or the connectivity of the street network, meaning how directly can you move from point A to B, as I showed in a graph previously. And you can see a steady decline, again, in kilograms of CO2 as connectivity increases. You can look and see number of retail parcels or how many destinations near where you live are you able to get to, and how does that relate with how much greenhouse gas emissions you create. Steady decline, but a bit of a threshold condition may occur at about 10 or 20 parcels of retail use, meaning if you have enough stuff near you, you're going to walk to it. So there's a bit of a critical mass possible condition there. I'll just mention what this is because it's a lot of information, but basically we've been looking at what sort of a reduction could we actually get if we had urban form policies that were more aggressive in terms of creating more walkable places. Projected out into the future in Seattle, we could see about a 24% reduction in vehicle miles traveled, which predicts about 93% or vehicle kilometers traveled of CO2 emissions. So it's pretty much a straight one-on-one shot, and you can see that's from a doubling of average connect of these urban form measures. So residential density, one we all understand, let's just take that. If we double it from 3.6 to about 7.3, we see a reduction. You know, you can see the average across the region. So it sounds horrific, like doubling walkability or all these urban form measures, but in fact, we're not a very, I mean, a lot of this region's fairly low density, fairly unwalkable. There's a lot of room for increasing the compactness through transit-oriented development. So it just shows the benefits of increasing the walkability of areas. It's intuitive, it might be obvious, but it actually is important to quantify if we want to make it a strategy for greenhouse gas emissions reduction. So you can see that it might matter, in, for example, in Seattle, that Queen Anne Hill is fairly walkable. It stacks up well for all these urban form measures. It could be akin to, let's say, Kitsilano in character and demography. Redmond is more like Surrey, perhaps. I don't know if it's more like any other place than Surrey, but it seems a little bit like Surrey to me. It's fairly automobile-oriented. It has a little bit of public transportation access as well, so it's kind of a mixture. And you can see there's significant differences, but the point is that it's not even fair to compare the two because one of them's out at the edge of the region, and it really doesn't matter how walkable it probably is overall. because in general, the distances to other destinations is really going to matter a lot. It's going to override, so you're not going to get a win-win between greenhouse gas emissions reduction with long commutes and physical activity benefits. In other words, wear really matters. So we're kind of kidding ourselves as we start to punch out large subdivisions in rural areas and then throw in recreational amenities and say, well, it's going to promote physical activity and reduce automobile dependence and call it smart growth and make it pretty. That's really not going to reduce people's use of the car. It's just not going to happen. It's not rational. You still have to drive a 2-ton or whatever, 1-ton piece of metal to get a loaf of bread. So basically, my last, I think, key point I want to make is that where all this evidence is at is what's called correlational. It's associative. We don't really have good evidence on causation at this point, meaning we don't really know the effect if we change the built environment. Like, if we were to do a study of all the Canada Line station areas, like we should be doing, and capture 200 households before and after the Canada Line opens and looked at the causal effect before and after for the same people, we would actually have baseline pre-post evidence and know what the effect might be if we could tease out other things and really understand what the real causal influence might be. So I want to point out to you an important factor is that people's preferences, whether they be for automobile or walkable neighborhoods along a continuum, and their choices are different. A lot of us don't live in our ideal urban form. In fact, some of us may prefer to be in a very walkable place, but we may live in a very unwalkable place. So this horizontal continua is where you live, what you've chosen, and the vertical is what you prefer. And what we can see, and this is the data set, all these different slides I've presented are papers that are published in different journals and are on our website, which I actually had in my first slide, and I can say again at the end if you wish, to know more, but basically this is from a paper called Stepping Towards Causation, published in Social Science and Medicine. And what this shows is basically for people in these different quadrants, I want to be in a walkable neighborhood, but I'm not. I might not be able to afford it. I want to be in a walkable neighborhood, and I am. I do not want to be in a walkable neighborhood, and I'm not. Matched preference and choice. And I am in a walkable neighborhood, and I want to get out. Okay? So those are your four quadrants of preference and choice. And what we've done is actually isolated the effect of preference from choice, so you can start to see what's really going on. And it's interesting that everybody above this line, quadrants 1 and 2, these are the folks that want to be in a walkable neighborhood. These are the folks that want to be and aren't. 16% say they took a walk trip over a 2-day period. Twice as many who want to be and are or are enabled actually said they walked. But interestingly, the vehicle miles traveled reduced significantly, same preference, different urban form. So the preferences are done in a very, very rigorous way, and I'll actually just mention that we forced trade-offs between 7 different paired comparisons so that people actually had to make a decision. If you want to have a bigger yard, you got to live further out and commute further. So those are, it's called conjoint. Below the line, you can see that basically these are the folks who do not want to be in a walkable neighborhood and aren't. Very few walk at all. You could say, from a statistical perspective, that more than 100% increase occurred for those who don't want to be and aren't and are in a walkable. Forget it. No one's walking. It's very low. Lawn statistics on pedestrian travel in downtown Seattle is the other end of the spectrum. But here you can see, interestingly, as you'd expect, that these are the folks that drive the most. But they also, who are in the unwalkable neighborhoods and don't want to and want to be in an unwalkable neighborhood, automobile dependent and like it. But basically, interesting, what I thought is that they drive if they are preferring to be in an automobile-oriented neighborhood, but let's say their partner, spouse, whatever, are for whatever reason, they're in a walkable neighborhood. They don't drive in distance much more or any more than people who prefer and are in a walkable neighborhood. And the reason is because the distances are shorter. So I know that I'm going to get kicked off this podium pretty quickly. But basically, I want to mention that these are the statistics that we've run. So back to the climate change side, because I think these are all interactive, or basically mutually reinforcing, is that we've run a variety of scenarios with the Center for Clean Air Policy tied through with the Brookings Institution in the U.S. on a different technological strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. And you can see basically the numbers here. To hit the 80% target, what has to happen is, in Seattle, the average person drives 27 miles per day. It looks like the average person in Seattle will be able to drive about 9, or a third as many vehicle miles of travel in the year 2050, about a third as being projected today, or is happening today. In fact, what's happening right now, and you can't see this, but vehicle miles of travel are increasing per capita and plus population growth. So we're completely going in the wrong direction in most regions, and in fact, we're heading in the wrong direction fast, and I think Anthony will be able to pick up on that thread pretty quickly. So I'll just mention last, this zoning is our key in terms of the land use. That's the tool we have. Zoning is predicated and was 81 or 82 years ago on health, safety, and welfare. That's the legal precedent for this tool. It is now arguable through exclusionary zoning or Euclidean zoning, where uses are separated and we force people to travel long distances where they can't walk and where air pollution is created, that it's counter to public health. It's only a matter of time before somebody who masses a large body of evidence and challenges the foundations of zoning based on its inability to uphold public health, safety, and welfare. Thank you.